but for the most part. Has your life improved with treatment? What have you learned about your personal character and strength through your journey? My advice, Tricia continues, would be to respect the needs of your body first. Regularly, we're faced with two options: fight and conceal what we feel to be embarrassing symptoms, or accept and explain our disease to ourselves and others. By honoring these self-defeating thoughts of, I'm not good enough, I'm not normal enough, I'm not beautiful the way I am, I'm unlovable, my disease is all I am, we encourage ourselves to crawl deeper into depression, anxiety, and isolation. Practice positive thinking. It's only natural to have moments of self-doubt when it comes to our appearance. We can't look perfect in every photo. We won't look perfect in every outfit we try on. Coming to peace with your body doesn't mean feeling entirely and completely satisfied with your appearance. It means you have accepted the reality that, at the moment, your physical health is more important than your vanity. Here are some tools to practice positive thinking when self-doubt creeps in. Find an outlet to express and challenge negative thoughts. For me, it was blogging. I needed to write down my daily experiences so I could remember the good days and know that I was not always unavailable to my friends and family. You may want to do the same. You could take up photography to capture the great things in life, or take on other creative projects that can help you compile the positive points in your life. Be at peace with your appearance. As I've already discussed, sometimes all it takes is a regular good look in the mirror. You may want to make a list of the parts of your body that you love, or the sports, activities, or talents that make your body unique. You may also want to put the clothes that you no longer feel look good on you into storage for a while. Maybe they'll look good again in the future, but they shouldn't be hanging in your closet as a daily reminder of where you no longer are. Start dressing for the body you have, and you'll experience less internal self-doubt over your appearance. You could also utilize other ways to highlight your best new features. Change your makeup routine. Find new fitness routines that you can manage that may focus on areas of your body that are not affected by your disease. For instance, you may have arthritic joints in your knees, but you're still able to do upper body workouts. You can focus more of your attention on toning your arms than on worrying about wearing short shorts. Look in the mirror with fresh eyes. I still have my running shoes by the door. I didn't stop buying clothes that both comforted and flattered me. And even on my ugliest days, I make the effort to look myself in the mirror and try my best to laugh. So, this may not be the best day for my glamour shots, I think, but I can't compare pictures of my friends at parties on Facebook to what I'm seeing in the mirror this morning. Our bodies are running through two entirely different worlds. It's in the comparison of those two worlds that compassion can get lost. In this chapter, we've discussed the shame we feel about how we see ourselves and how we feel others perceive us. We've considered how focusing on the positive and familiarizing ourselves with our new bodies can help us cope with bodily shame. And lastly, we've discussed how to cultivate a new attitude to increase confidence and acceptance. It's never too late to start looking in the mirror with fresh eyes. Practice positive self-talk and take the bullying down a notch. In the next chapter, we'll explore how others may react and respond to your illness, and just how much your attitude about your disease plays a role in that. Chapter 3. What They're Going to Say About You. Most people in your life may feel inconvenienced by your chronic illness. To them, the solution seems simple. Just stop being sick. They may think of you as lazy, attention-seeking, weak-willed, or reckless. These perceptions seem to always be present in interactions with friends and family and are reinforced when you need to cancel plans, can't make family dinners, or need to head home early from work. The pressure of committing to events is raised tenfold. Will you be accused of being selfish if you need to cancel or back out? Will they think you're uninterested or too good for their company? In this chapter, we're going to discuss your relationships with other people, how your disease affects your social life, and how to use tools to handle miscommunications about your symptoms. We'll explore how your disease informs the reality of your relationships, and map out why those people in your life may not be ready to handle your situation. We'll offer useful tools for opening the conversation and clearing the air, as well as helping you to determine which people you should be surrounding yourself with and who it's time to take a break from. The realities of your relationships. A few years ago, I started following this woman, Allie, on Facebook. She was always in the hospital, and at the time, so was I. While I grumbled and bitched about the cold rooms and invasive procedures, Allie was literally having her head drained of spinal fluid day after day with a smile on. Allie had been diagnosed with intracranial hypotension. As limiting as her outcome looked, and as often as she had to shave her head for brain surgery, she remained positive, almost mocking it in her own determinedly cheerful way. She would share pictures of her head in bandages, the piles of life-sustaining machinery surrounding her, and Disney princess coloring books and handmade blankets that her nurses or friends had made for her. But I would always wonder, where is Allie's family? The answer was disappointing, but not surprising. "Before my diagnoses, everybody thought I was faking it," said Allie. Despite her constant headaches and vomiting, dizziness, and balance issues, she struggled to obtain their support. Her mother wasn't interested in helping her find answers from her local teaching hospital. She was only interested in taking Allie for alternative therapies, fearing any more complicated treatment might injure her further. The rest of her family failed to understand her condition as well. The constant comments included, "I wish I had a headache so I could stay home all day," or, "If you wouldn't pass out all the time, I wouldn't be embarrassed to go out with you." It's not entirely surprising to see family members react to a diagnosis of an invisible disease with insensitive comments like these. Like Allie's family, many can only make sense of the peripheral perks of disease. When they don't see a condition as valid, they feel as though someone is taking handicapped privileges and exploiting them, and they feel the need to react accordingly. Sometimes the reactions are in the form of accusatory comments or ignoring the person in pain, and sometimes the interactions lead to hostility and fighting. Education will be your best and sometimes only tool in these cases. Dragging family or friends to doctor appointments and hospital stays and printing out literature from a disease organization's website can give you a chance to start a conversation about your illness with them. Discussing how the disease affects the body, the long-term outlook of the condition, and what other patients in similar situations have done will help your loved ones better understand how they can support you. Unfortunately, Allie did not receive the support she needed from her parents. She said, "Once I finally had my first diagnosis, my mom did a little bit of research, but still was only interested in alternative therapy until the doctors told her it needed to be handled differently. Still to this day, my dad isn't aware of all the diseases I face or the treatments I do. He still makes rude comments telling me how lazy I am and how disappointed he is." Allie still wants support from her parents, especially during difficult surgeries and debilitating flares. But she understands that because her parents have never experienced anything like her health issues, they may not ever have the capacity to empathize. There are many patients out there who will never feel completely supported by family and friends. The great pillar of strength that's supposed to help you through the hard times may not be there at the time your first symptoms hit. As you grow and learn more about yourself and your disease, you'll be able to build your support system. Allie began to befriend student nurses who often worked with her doctors. She became a regular at the hospital and consequently found that her family of support was the hospital staff. She continued to grow support by making friends online and through her school. In the absence of her family's understanding of her disease, Allie managed to create a wonderful team of support. We cannot back down from the idea that we are deserving of support and understanding in our time of need. But the reality is, we might not get it from the people we expect it from. Dawn Wiggins, the licensed marriage and family therapist from Chapter 1, shed some light on why Allie's family had difficulty coping with her disease. For Allie, I would guess that the reason behind her unsupportive family not giving her the support she wants or needs is about feelings of powerlessness, says Wiggins. In my experience, most loved ones just want to solve the problem. When families don't understand the illness and when medical science has a difficult time understanding and treating that condition, it leads to a feeling of powerlessness. Powerlessness is such a strong and uncomfortable feeling that many will do anything they can to avoid it. So, how can you tell if your family members or friends are feeling powerless? Wiggins says some clues this may be the case is when they are acting like they have the solution, try to control the situation, or are pushing their feelings onto someone else, like the patient or their spouse. These feelings and behaviors can ultimately cause some painful conversations, accusations, and erosion of crucial relationships. In these cases, well-meaning family members end up hurting the people they care most about. For Wiggins, the first step in this situation is similar to what we covered in Chapter 1. Most patients just want to be heard and reassured that our lives aren't going to end as a result of our illness. My professional suggestion to caretakers and loved ones is to focus on acceptance of the circumstances as they are today and to understand that healing is a process, a continuous one. As we have learned in the last two chapters, acceptance is something that you need to cultivate as well. You are the ultimate model for how people will treat you and your situation. The following are some tips for when a well-meaning person tries to help, but unwittingly provokes your anger and frustration by thinking they can solve a problem you can't. Recognize this isn't a personal attack. They are trying to help in the only way they know how. Acknowledge their support while politely letting them know that the way they're going about it is ineffective. Give them ways in which they can help. For example, helping you get to the doctor, going on a disease organization's website and reading up on the facts, and simply being there to support you emotionally during procedures or other moments when you're in need. Unease about your disease. Even my mother, my greatest supporter, at times felt her own sense of powerlessness to assist me. She told me that once when she was thinking that there must be something more to this that I wasn't telling her, she rifled through my drawers and swiped her hands under my mattress looking for empty packets of laxatives. This kind of thinking was something I was often faced with. People would say, "She's probably taking diet pills. You don't just have excruciating stomach pain for no reason. How many scopes has she had at this point? 10? And they found nothing?" I can always remember my mom advocating for me, but there were moments I saw her doubt her own resolve. Maybe these symptoms were just psychological. She had to do something. In addition to all my specialists, she took me to acupuncturists, herbalists, chiropractors, and a series of psychologists and psychiatrists. Though her faith wavered in how much of my disease was physical, she still supported me in front of my relatives, co-workers, friends, and teachers. She advocated for me in hospitals and doctor's appointments. Considering the blurriness of my diagnosis, she took a considerable leap of faith and went to incredible lengths to combat her skepticism. However, in my family, the reality of my situation often got lost in translation. Most of my family members had different theories on why I was unwell. Sometimes these judgments were innocent. Other times, they were downright malicious. Here were some of their conclusions. I was doing this to myself because of my diet. She should be gluten-free. She should be on paleo. She needs to eat more, not less. I was taking too much the wrong kind of medication. She obviously just needs to be on Xanax all the time. If she would just get off all those crazy medications, I'm sure she'd be fine. Can't they just give her something to make her normal again? She really needs to get prescribed something to fix that. I enjoyed the daily life of a patient. Sure, I'd fake an illness too if it meant I got to stay home all day and never have to work a real job. Wow, she really likes going to those doctor's appointments, doesn't she? I think she likes all the attention she gets in the emergency room. There's plenty to judge when you're a witness and not the patient. Lifelong diseases test your decision-making skills and make people around you confident that they could make better choices. The people in your life will have unease about your disease. They may express this through teasing, failing to be there for you, or arguing about your treatment plan. Learning how to recognize this unease and understanding that it is a defense technique and not about your worth as a person in need of support is a start to building the support system that you will most definitely need. The fallout of support. When you find yourself sick, your relationships will undoubtedly be tested. There comes a time when you will have no choice but to mindfully examine your friendships. Who will step up? What role will they play in making that relationship even stronger? Who will raise you up? Who will let you down and why? It is a bummer to think about, but it is common for people to let you down. Feeling powerless doesn't feel good, and your family and friends will do their best to avoid it. The most likely result is that their support for you will fall away. How does that work? What does this fallout look like? When someone first gets severely injured in an accident, the people in their world rush to give support. Who wouldn't want to be there for a friend or family member in need, incapacitated, and probably depressed about having to postpone their life for a few days or possibly weeks? The second time someone gets injured, the support system tends to rally just a little slower, providing a little less encouragement, and they may even jokingly question if that person is intentionally getting into accidents for the sympathy. The days it will leave them out of work, or a variety of other excuses. Having a chronic illness works the same way. Let's take Joey's story as an example of how this fallout of support can happen. At 25 years old, my older sister's boyfriend, Joey, was diagnosed with a rare form of pancreatic cancer. I remember the feeling of my stomach dropping as I listened to her breaking the news over the phone. I raced to show my support, to do my share of research, to make calls and care packages, and be an ear for venting frustrations. I had been a patient in crisis, and I knew exactly what to do. 2 weeks later, none of Joey's or my sister's friends managed to show any sign of support or comfort. My heart broke for them again. Why weren't people popping out of the woodwork to be there for them? My sister asked me on the phone, exactly what part of my boyfriend has pancreatic cancer do they not understand? I knew my sister had great friendships with people all over the country. Didn't they know what a crisis this was? That's when I realized that, no, they probably didn't. They probably had no idea what this could be like. They were young adults who most likely had never known someone that was their age with cancer. They didn't know if what Joey needed was support or privacy. They probably had no idea what to say, so they said nothing at all. Sound familiar? Support is not an instinct. It doesn't come naturally to people who have never experienced that kind of disaster. It doesn't mean they don't care, that they don't want to care, or that they're bad people for not diving headfirst into the water to fish you out. While some may try ineffectually, and sometimes offensively, to support you, others may completely vanish altogether. What they say about you isn't fueled by you or your disease, but rather, it is greatly influenced by how small and ineffective they feel. In the face of something so large and ambiguous that they have no power to make better. People need information and experience to effectively show support. In most cases, the people in your life will not be able to fully relate to what you're going through. They may not have a chronic illness. They may not have experienced being a caregiver or an emotional support for another patient in their lives. Help them to help you by communicating what it is that is happening, how you're feeling about it, and maybe even linking them to some resources explaining what your condition is and how it progresses. Most importantly, let them know that their support is key to you getting through this. A statement like that will empower them to go the extra mile, learn about your illness, and feel like they have an important role to play in your recovery. They need to understand the diagnosis. Consider sending them links to a website that might explain it more plainly. Sharing these kinds of informative articles on social media can also help friends get a clearer view of what's going on behind the scenes. They need to see what has changed. Before Joey's diagnosis, he was your average Seattle-based 20-something. Then, he lost 30 pounds in a short amount of time, could no longer work, and had to take time off his day job. He felt pain across his back and abdomen from where the tumor was pressing on his spleen and liver. But Joey still looked like Joey. How could anyone really notice a difference in him? They need to understand the treatment. On his first day of chemo, everyone in Joey's sphere of support was on pins and needles. We'd all heard what kind of aggressive treatment he was about to receive. We knew that he would likely feel sick and nauseated and be drugged and in pain. We were informed. There were plenty of people in Joey's life who cared for him. But how could they know how critical a day like that could be if they didn't really know much about how chemo works? They need to know that they're needed. After weeks of radio silence from friends and relatives, my sister finally allowed me to set up a donation site to help Joey afford some alternative treatment options to deal with his side effects, help cover some living costs while they took off work to navigate treatment, and make sure they had backup funds for emergencies. I created the site and put up a detailed story of what had happened so far in his treatment and what the next steps were. Within 2 days, we raised several thousand dollars, most of which came from their friends and family. But what came with each donation mattered most. The notes of love and support came flooding in, and with them, notes of regret for not understanding the gravity of the situation sooner. A diagnostic mouthful. When they're ready to listen, what do I say? Learning to talk to your family about your disease is one of the largest hurdles you'll encounter. Educating them about your disease can sometimes feel like trying to teach advanced trigonometry to a 4-year-old. But learning to communicate on this topic is the best way to avoid misunderstanding and to assuage their lingering feelings of powerlessness. You must communicate with people who have their hands over their ears. When people you love don't understand what is really happening, you may find they don't stick around. I'd even recommend over-communicating with them. Write an email, send a letter, make a phone call, write a status update, spell it out with chocolate frosting, embarrass them with a singing telegram. What happens when you're confronted about your disease and asked to explain it and you freeze? Where do you even start? It can be kind of crazy how long you could go on about what your disease has done to your life without mentioning how. Your disease can feel like an insurmountable thing to describe on the spot. I know mine did. Let's break it down by looking at some of the major impacts your disease has on your day. Here are some questions to get you started thinking about how you would respond. Do I wake up feeling good, or do I wake up feeling like I haven't slept at all? Do I have to take multiple medications before getting a move on in the morning? Do I need to use assistive devices or avoid parts of my normal morning routine? Do I have to think more deliberately about how comfortable the clothes are that I'll need to wear? Do I have to make decisions about every meal? What will give me the most energy? What could possibly throw me into a flare? What do I have in my fridge that won't make me sick? Do I go to a job that I worry I'll lose because my employers might find me less valuable if they know about my disease? Do I have the energy for a social life anymore? Do I have to spend all my money on medical expenses? You'll also want to decide how much you want others to know when it comes to the details of your condition. Are you comfortable sharing the details on what your feeding tube or ostomy bag helps with? Do you want them to know about what kind of medications you take or treatments you take part in? Do you want them to know how many doctors you see, how often you're hospitalized? The answers to these questions will vary from person to person. Your long-distance relative who you rarely see and only talk with on the phone once a year may not need to know about the results from your last blood test, but your best friend has probably been waiting to hear back about it just as anxiously as you have. Your coworkers may need to know specifics about how your environment impacts your disease, such as keeping the thermostat at an even temperature, not being able to sit through long meetings, or having to telecommute from time to time. You may even want to alter your responses based on how much time you have to explain it, whether or not you're in a professional or social setting, or simply how open you feel that day. Whatever your decision, it helps to develop a standard elevator pitch. How can I quickly explain my disease? There's been far too many embarrassing moments in my life where I've had to introduce myself and then my disease in the same breath, quickly summoning up primary immune deficiency, let alone the other illnesses I've been diagnosed with, in one breath takes Olympic lungs that I just don't have. Ever heard of something called an elevator pitch? It's a term used to describe a short statement that quickly sums up a business proposal. Getting a person to understand the intricacies of life with a rare or chronic disease in just a few short words will be useful in many life situations. An elevator pitch may end up being one of your greatest tools when it comes to advocating for your needs or accommodations. Here are some tips on perfecting your pitch quickly and accurately without getting that blank stare in return. Ask before you explain. It's rare, but sometimes people have heard of your disease and don't even need to hear your spiel. Before breaking into the song and dance, preface your pitch by saying, "I have a disease called primary immune deficiency. Are you familiar with it?" This statement does two things. It verifies whether someone knows what your disease already is, and it gives them the option of asking for more information if they don't. After all, nothing is weirder than an unsolicited lesson on your complicated health issues. Don't get too technical. Instead of focusing on the pathology of your disease or breaking down the genetics of it, try to focus on how the disease affects you as a person. You may want to say that because of this disease, you're more susceptible to infection, which means you might have to be more cautious than the average person. You may choose to say that your body doesn't produce the natural defenses against infection, so you have medication to replace it. Or that some days you feel completely normal and can function just like everyone else, and some days you feel like you got hit by a train. Use analogies or familiarities. What can you relate your disease to that this person will understand? This can be altered for situations in which you're speaking to children, adults, and even doctors who are unfamiliar with your condition. People with Crohn's disease might say something like, "Living with Crohn's is like carrying around a ticking time bomb. One wrong bite and you can set off a painful stomach ache that can knock you out for the rest of the day or week." I've heard others describe immune disorders as, "Having a chronic illness is like being the only one casually walking through a war zone every day without any armor on, and then people are shocked and confused when you get a few bullet holes in your chest." Mention what it doesn't affect. This part is one patients often forget to include. Don't forget to tell inquiring minds what you still can do despite your disease. Remind them that you can still work, go to school, see your friends, or go out for a few hours a day. Let them know if you can still do things like communicate online or on the phone and see your family and friends. This helps remove yourself from the pity equation and gives them an in to be included in some of these parts of your life. Keep it short and shut it down. The whole point of an elevator pitch is to avoid a long-winded, and often depressing, conversation about your disease. Keep your explanation short, concise, and to the point. "This is what I have, this is how it works, now let's go get some tacos." A good way to bring the conversation to a screeching halt is to say something along the lines of, "It's kind of complicated, but I hope that explains some of it. You can always Google it later if you want. Wikipedia might give you a better idea of how it all goes down." Remember that the way you discuss your disease is the way that others will interpret it. If you give a humorless, depressing description of your disease, you'll inevitably leave your audience bummed out. Don't be afraid to have fun with it. For instance, you could finish your speech by gently grasping their shoulder and saying, "And it's highly, highly contagious, just kidding." My elevator speech. When it came to developing my own elevator speech, I knew I had to find a way to describe my rare diseases in a more familiar way. I also realized that while my diseases were serious, it would create a very weird vibe if I went into the doom and gloom of how it impacted my life. I had to keep it light. It took a while, but here is the elevator speech I ultimately came up with. "I have two diseases, primary immune deficiency and dysautonomia. Ever heard of them? That's okay. No one usually has. One affects my immune system. Have you ever seen that movie, The Boy in the Plastic Bubble? It's kind of like that, but not as serious and way more under control. Just give me a heads up if you have anything contagious, though, okay? I also have a neurological disease that throws my autonomic system into disaster mode. Anything that should be automatic in the body, heart, sleep, temperature, and digestion, is basically running on manual via a ton of medication. The bad news is that there's not really any one specific treatment for this. The good news is that I've become extremely multitask-oriented." Ready? Now it's your turn to talk. How would you explain your condition to a new person in your life? Write down some elevator speech drafts in your journal, and then try them out. Extended family and estranged family. Your nuclear family is one challenge, but your extended family and your estranged family are a whole new ballgame. Keeping your extended family in the loop should be done on an as-needed and as-wanted basis. Technically, if your disease is not going to affect your extended family, they don't need to understand what you're going through in depth. If you don't prefer their help with things like getting to and from doctor's appointments or having them visit while you're in the hospital, there is no rule saying you have to say anything other than, "I'm sick, but I'm managing it." If you have an estranged relative, maybe a parent who you no longer keep an active relationship with, I find the best way to communicate any update in your health is via email. After all, this isn't a discussion, it's a notification. Dealing with the accusations of a fictitious disorder. Experiencing your loved ones turn away from you during a period of illness is heartbreaking. However, there are even worse scenarios that can occur when sharing the details of your disease. For example, one mother, Paula, recalls the horror story of her time in court fighting for treatment for her youngest child with an immune and antibody deficiency disease. My husband's accusations that I was over-medicalizing my child caused the Department of Children and Families to start an investigation on me. It was unreal. As unreal as it feels, it is ignorant to think that even court judges are above the standard response to a complicated and invisible illness. Paula continues, the judge in our case said she did a little bit of researching online about my daughter's illness and that she concluded that it was not a real disease. I was floored. I was standing there with medical documents clearly stating her diagnosis from top board-certified doctors. Throughout our time in court, the judge refused to look at the documents and refused to hear from my daughter's doctor as an expert witness. This situation seems difficult to believe, but unfortunately, it's one that's happening all too frequently to families with children touched by invisible illness. The number of autoimmune and other inflammatory diseases without known cures is on the rise. Medicine is slowly catching up and recognizing that they do exist. When a child is sick and doesn't recover in a reasonable amount of time, there may be inquiries into whether or not the child is being abused, neglected, malnourished, or whether they're having behavioral issues or not. When these kinds of situations are called into question during legal proceedings, it can result in loss of custody, even when a parent is trying their best to get answers. For Paula, her case was finally settled without losing custody. She was also able to find support from other parents who had been through similar traumas. Though Paula's case is extreme, it is illustrative of the common response to accuse rather than relate. A problem Wiggins identifies as also being particularly damaging for the undiagnosed is being accused of faking their illness. Patients suffering without diagnostic confirmation may also suffer inaccurate accusations like fictitious disorder, formerly known as Munchausen. And family members aren't always the only ones capable of damaging accusations. Wiggins points out that even doctors can do it. In my experience, doctors are trained to be experts and pride themselves on being good diagnosticians with the ability to provide appropriate treatment. I've witnessed countless medical professionals assure a patient with a rare diagnosis that his or her unique approach to medicine will provide a cure or solution, when in the end, the doctor was not able to effect any change. This is frustrating for both doctor and patient. When doctors can't find solutions, they respond the way many people respond to failure: blame. In this case, a doctor feeling inadequate to solve a medical problem may blame the problem on the patient or caregiver by referencing fictitious disorder. No one needs a heaping pile of blame in addition to the already burdensome life of chronic illness. In my experience, I grew up around doctors who accused me of faking or exaggerating symptoms. They sneered. They prescribed me medications I'd already tried. They told me to change my diet, exercise regimen, or sleeping schedule. They told me it was all in my head. Or they would take one look at my chart and assure me it wasn't all in my head, but that nothing could be done. In the absence of blame and frustration, there is only one remaining response: a declaration of powerlessness and an apology, because they know they won't be the one able to help you. When it comes to dealing with doctors who believe you may be faking your symptoms, Wiggins advises, if you are someone who has been accused of faking symptoms or fictitious disorder by your doctor, stay calm and consider finding a new medical provider. Be honest with your treatment team. Tell them if you have experienced this accusation and demonstrate your willingness to cooperate with diagnostic or investigative suggestions that will lead to proper diagnosis. When someone blames you for a problem, your automatic response may be to defend yourself. Defensiveness only increases your own anxiety and feelings of self-doubt. In the instance of being blamed or accused of something untrue, instead of defending, try to problem solve in a productive manner by seeking treatment by professionals that think outside of the box and are eager to support your health and well-being. Though your first reaction may be feelings of anger or hopelessness, try to resist. You know your body. Don't allow your observations to be denied. You may not have your answers yet, but you must keep working towards them through meticulous documentation, organization, and by not letting your emotions color your path to better health. Sometimes that means seeing a therapist to help you deal with the real impact of living with incredible medical stress. This is also helpful on another level, since your primary doctor may request that your mental health be professionally evaluated. Sharing your truth, establishing boundaries, and finding forgiveness. Hopefully, this chapter has provided some understanding of how and why others react the way they do to mentions of your disease. The tools learned here, like your elevator speech, will help you to share your story quickly and without awkwardness. You should now have a better idea of which people in your life you may need to take a step back from, and which people you should give a chance to understand what you're going through. Finding forgiveness for those who fail to support you along the way takes time, and many conversations you never thought you'd need to have with the people who are supposed to love you no matter what. For many people, family is a tough social network to navigate, whether they live far away or intentionally distance themselves. When family members make themselves unavailable, it's good to have new faces to turn to. In the next chapter, we'll discuss how you can keep your illness from alienating you socially. Chapter 4. Making New Friendships and Salvaging Old Ones. Didn't think you'd need a how-to guide on how to make friends after kindergarten, did you? Don't be embarrassed. Chronic illness can make you miss out on a lot of great things, including building those friendships and relationships that you need to stay strong and feel normal. When you're just trying to stay above water with work or school, getting your treatment settled, and trying to find your footing each time a fresh wave of symptoms hits, who has time for a social life? The answer is that you do, or rather, you should make time. Think of your social life as being as vital as any other treatment for your disease, not as a privilege for the healthy. The U.S. National Academy of Sciences conducted a study in 2016 that found that a higher degree of social integration was associated with lower risk of physiological dysregulation in a dose-response manner in both early and later life. Conversely, lack of social connections was associated with vastly elevated risk in specific life stages. In other words, make friends or risk spending most of your time focusing on and thus intensifying your worst symptoms. Your network gives you an outlet to forget, refocus, push through, and at the worst of times, well, they might just make you laugh. As you move out of high school and college, or you need to resort to homeschooling or telecommuting for your career, you've probably realized that it is really hard to make friends when there aren't that many people you get to interact with daily. Try to remember that inevitably there will be periods in your life that you will be alone. This isn't exclusive to those with chronic illness. This is an entirely human experience that happens to everyone, as they struggle to figure out who they are and with whom they feel comfortable. Don't panic. This isn't forever. Remember what we discussed in Chapter 1 about acceptance. You aren't defeated. You aren't forgotten. Don't heap any more self-defeating thoughts onto yourself. Accept that this moment happens universally. Just because you've been alone for a long time doesn't mean that you can't have a social recovery. There is always a time and a chance to make new friends or recover old ones. Coming out about my disease was like stepping out into the sun while squinting. I didn't know what was going to come at me. I worried about insults and accusations of faking or attention-seeking. But when I finally opened my eyes and took in the world around me, I found understanding and compassion from others that I hadn't even yet learned to give to myself. This chapter will give many examples of how to maintain old and new friendships. Ultimately, the true test of a lasting friendship is how badly both of you want it to continue, despite whatever you might endure in life. How to maintain friendships. Chronic illness has made me look at my friendships in a totally new way. The nature of each friendship is different. For example, I have a friend I have dinner with every few months, and we end up catching up for hours because we don't see each other often. I have a friend who works near my neighborhood and likes to come by on her lunch hour and hang out with me before she heads back to work. I have a group of friends that I gather for parties at my house, even if I haven't seen them since last year's pumpkin carving bash. I have a friend in New York who I only got to see for 20 minutes earlier this year, but being wrapped up in her arms had me feeling all the emotion and love of a 20-year-long friendship. Friendships change according to the seasons of your life. This would happen whether you were sick or healthy. Sometimes you might take a sabbatical from a friendship and find yourself walking back in as if nothing has happened a year later. Do your best to hang on to the good friends, the ones who make the effort to support you, even when you can barely support yourself. Here are a few ways to maintain friendships, even when you find yourself unavailable. Speak up. Don't be afraid to tell your friends what's happening in your life. If you're having a particularly rough flare, at least give them the opportunity to be there for you by letting them know. I was surprised how many people stepped out of the woodwork when I finally started opening up about how often I was in the hospital. Check in. Make sure there is never too long of a gap in the conversation. Keep your buddies nearby via text messages, phone calls, Facebook, etc. For me, writing a blog about my journey was my invitation for support. You don't have to write a novel about your disease, but consider writing a Facebook status and letting others know when you've checked into the ER or have been admitted to the hospital. Make the plans. Don't leave it up to your friends to set a date. Take control by making low-key, realistic plans for your energy level. Maybe go for a quiet night out at a restaurant whose menu you know you can eat from. You can even invite friends over to watch a new release on Netflix, or to create a new recipe together. Why are you not making friends? There are some very universal reasons that chronic illness patients struggle with making friends. We struggle with shame and worthiness. You may think, who would want to be friends with someone who cancels plans, spends long periods of time in the hospital, and is constantly in some amount of discomfort or pain? Shame is a natural reaction to having an illness. For many people, shame sneaks in without a name or a face and completely alters your perception of yourself. It is the most hazardous factor in preventing you from connecting with other people. Shame makes you hide things and pretend things are fine when they're extremely painful. Not only are social situations difficult to get through, it becomes harder and harder to believe that being with other people can be enjoyable. How lonely! When I think about failures in friend-making when I was younger, I know it goes a lot deeper than not sharing the same interests. You might lack the confidence to share yourself with others when you don't know how or when to reveal your disease. Before I knew what my disease was, I was hiding it. Keeping my symptoms quiet and concealed around other people was my marching order. Do you ever feel like that's been your experience? The truth is that my disease made me feel very different from other people. I always had this chip on my shoulder and felt like I could never take things to the next level. I couldn't get close to people because I felt that eventually I would flare up and let them down. It took me many years to find the strength to even try to be someone's friend. It took even more time to learn that, unlike for other people, keeping and strengthening those friendships was going to take effort and commitment. But having those lonely stretches without a social life gave me more strength to pursue and appreciate my friendships when I finally did have the opportunity to connect with people. Making and breaking plans is a common theme for people with chronic illness. It doesn't change much from being a sickly 10-year-old to a sickly 24-year-old. Finding the right restaurants to eat at, deciding on activities that won't require much activity, and having to cancel last minute for things you can't really control makes it tricky to maintain close friendships. Uneasiness with your disease is extremely obvious to others. When you start to get comfortable about your condition, you'll put others at ease as well, and it will be easier to make friends and maintain those relationships. How to start making friends. If you've been off the social stratosphere for way too long, to the point where you're having intense conversations with your dog or crying into your birthday cake while your mom watches on, it's okay. It happens. Getting back in the saddle after a long flare-up can feel like you are attempting to meaningfully converse in another language when you only know how to say, "Where is the bathroom?" You may have completely lost confidence in yourself and your ability to make friends, and that's expected. Here are some reminders and ideas of ways to connect with people. 1. Draw on your current contacts. Check in to see how old friends are doing. Use your social networks to send messages and see if they might want to get coffee soon. Remember who you used to hang out with in healthier times and reconnect. Ask how their lives have changed since you last spoke. 2. Be kind. Seems obvious, right? Make a conscious effort to be kind. Compliment a stranger. Make a comment to a classmate or coworker about their presentation during a meeting. Congratulate another mom at the park for keeping her cool when her kid went all exorcist style on the monkey bars for not being allowed to have candy. Kindness invites kindness. So don't be afraid to notice someone's better qualities. 3. Reach out. During my first week of high school, I spent the first week or two having lunch by myself. I had homeschooled the year before, and now finding myself in a crowd of other teenagers felt really jarring. Then, out of the clear blue, a girl tapped me on the shoulder and asked me to come and sit with her and her friends. She did it with such confidence and nonchalance. Why, after all these months, had I not asked another person if I could sit with them? Reach out. Just ask. You very well may be the only person excluding yourself from a social life. 4. Get their contact info. Once you've made a connection with someone, make sure you ask for their phone number and let them know you'll text them soon to hang out. 5. Don't fear spontaneity. If your symptoms are mostly under control for the day, and a conversation results in an invitation to hang out, go for it. Seize the moment to socialize as often as your body allows you to. Where can you meet people? Patients with chronic illness do not have a monopoly on loneliness. Everyone goes through periods of time where they outgrow old friends before finding new ones. It's difficult, especially in your adult years, to effortlessly slide into a group of people who you can connect with. But there are places to make friends. I've provided some ideas below to get you started. Meet friends online. One of the hardest questions is, where are all the people? They weren't in my living room. They weren't at my doctor's office. My first foray into finding new friendships came from the internet and connecting with others who had a chronic illness. The positive aspect of this was that I no longer had to hold back and hide the symptoms of my disease. I could share my challenges at leisure. The downside was that often, besides our diseases, we really had nothing else in common. Sometimes these friendships tended to turn into merely sounding boards for complaints about our diseases. In the earlier days of my diagnosis, I would do online searches of the main organizations for my disease and set up an account to get in their chat rooms or forums. Later, I discovered a huge and ever-expanding series of Facebook groups for people with chronic illnesses. Many communities had 5,000 members or more who were all reading and responding to posts in real time. The benefit of this was checking to see if things were normal. People would pop in and ask questions like, "Is it normal for my heart to be racing this fast?" In a few seconds, there would be 50 responses from other patients who had been there before. Sometimes I'd get brave and ask to go to lunch with someone from an online group who lived nearby me. These lunch dates were very reaffirming since we shared similar daily realities. I started to wonder, though, if I would only be able to connect with people with chronic illness. How would someone who wasn't ill know how to be a friend to someone as complicated as me? As we discuss different kinds of support later in the book, you'll see the incredible value of finding friends in similar situations, but certainly they were not the end-all, be-all to my social needs. In the meantime, virtual friends can provide streaming support on those quiet nights at home. Make friends at school and work. School and work may be the easiest venue for finding new friends. You're already with people your own age, who at least have an education or a career in common with you. There's plenty of opportunity to talk at lunch, before classes and meetings, and during breaks. Even at the height of my disease, during my last year in college, I managed to make a very fragile friendship with a girl who sat behind me in class. Once or twice, we tested each other with flashcards in the cafeteria before tests. Because I had to leave school, I thought I had lost a potential friendship. Months went by, and then, by happenstance, she appeared at a house party my boyfriend had dragged me to, and we were able to reconnect. That's the thing about friendships. They don't always start with a flash and a bang. Sometimes they come in the form of acquaintances you see every now and then and grow to become strong friendships. Be open to all opportunities by being kind and open with everyone you interact with. You have nothing to be ashamed of by putting yourself out there. Coworkers might not immediately seem to have the same after-work social life as you, but give yourself time to get to know them. When you make a connection, there may be no better feeling in the world than the one you get sitting across from someone who you fully connect with. It's like taking off two tight sneakers after a long walk. There is an incredible relief and appreciation for the moment. You weren't sure if the opportunity to connect would ever actually come again, and it did. You broke through. Despite the wall that your disease can build around you, you found a window, popped your head out, and waved to someone on the other side. Things are looking up. Now that you have made a connection, there are a few things to be mindful of. Make plans you can keep. After the friendly flirting and Netflix queue comparison, you've finally landed a friend date. And since you likely just met this person, you probably haven't told them all the details of your disease. The thought of making plans seem like an insurmountable challenge because you want to appear normal and do normal activity-level things for someone your age, eat normal everyday food like someone your age, and discuss normal age-appropriate life experiences. But you don't quite fit into any of those bubbles. Different diseases present different challenges to hanging out. It's not something the healthy have to think about, but you do. So let's knock some things out of the equation right now. Eating spicy foods when it upsets your stomach? Don't do it just because everyone else wants to order the chili. Getting in line for the new roller coaster when your worst symptom is vertigo? Don't do it. Intense physical exercise like endurance hiking or fast-paced aerobic classes? Find another activity. If it makes you feel any better, I've learned all this from trying to pretend that I'm on the same peak physical level as my friends. I nearly dislocated my ankle twice while ice skating, went to see an IMAX movie in the middle of a migraine flare, and even had something as simple as a slice of pizza